This podcast is made on the lands of the Wurundjeri people, the Wurrung and the Boonwurrung. We'd like to acknowledge and pay respects to their elders, both past and present, and emerging. From the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne, this is Psych Talks.
Hello, Lynn Malcolm here again with Psych Talks, our series which explores today's big issues from the perspective of psychology research. This episode is all about big data. Increasingly, it feels like the information about us on the web is being used against us, from insidious advertising to cyber attacks. But could this data about our lives also be harnessed for the greater good, to better understand the inner workings of the human mind? To help get a better picture of what big data means for us today, we're starting off in the world of video sharing social media platform TikTok.
I will not be lectured about sexism and misogyny by this man.
I make feminist, comedic content. A lot of it can be lip syncing or things off TV shows that I think can apply to political situations.
This is TikToker Abby Hansen, who goes by the handlebar Minor Fauna.
If he wants to know what misogyny looks like in modern Australia, he doesn't need a...
Abby first gained popularity on the app with her video lip-syncing former Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard's iconic misogyny speech. But just as her video went viral, she and other TikTokers faced having it all disappear.
The government announced that there were growing concerns around TikTok users' data, and they sort of were making it very clear that TikTok was owned by this company, ByteDance, which was a Chinese-owned company. And they sort of made out as though TikTok was this Chinese data mining tool that was disguised as a social media platform. And so because of that, they really wanted to ban it.
This was back in mid-2020. And Abby found herself caught up in the ensuing media storm.
That video about Julia Gillard's misogyny speech was circulating around on different social media platforms and in the media and stuff. So different media were reaching out to me for comments and stuff like that.
And do you have privacy concerns about TikTok?
I mean, not really. I have read the terms and conditions of TikTok's privacy stuff, and it's very similar to Instagram and Facebook. And then TikTok Australia also explained that user data is not stored in China. It's actually stored in Singapore and the US. And they had no intention of sharing this data with the Chinese government, even if it was requested that they share it. So that sort of put me at ease in terms of privacy concerns with TikTok.
The Australian government ended up backing down on its proposed TikTok ban. Yet the debate about what harm TikTok and other online platforms and services pose for data security and our privacy still rages on.
Big data means a lot of different things to different people, I think. But I guess more recently, what it's really come to mean is big personal data. So your clicks, your GPS locations, your purchase histories.
This is privacy and data expert Professor Simon Dennis from the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences.
Companies have become more adept at gaining insights from that data. And so that happens, you know, as it gets accumulated, the more there is, the more insight you can draw. But it also comes because the algorithms that the companies are using are becoming more sophisticated. This is particularly true in text analysis, where so-called neural net or deep learning networks have become more and more capable in terms of understanding what the text really means.
Very often you see these services represented as enhance the value of your customers sort of thing.
We're also hearing from data security consultant Troy Hunt. Troy says that businesses are increasingly turning to data aggregators. These middlemen are capable of analysing personal data across multiple sources to build up a picture of who a person is and what their habits and preferences are.
You know, let's take the person's email address, and then we'll go to one of these data aggregators, and we can take that email address and we can then turn that into where they live, their demographic, their age group. Crikey, look at how far you can target with like Facebook ads. It's like, what do you like to eat for breakfast? Let's target the people who eat muesli rather than toast. But then if we go a little bit into the shadier end, there have been numerous services out there that have simply taken data breaches and sold the data. I myself have been found in multiple data breaches from aggregators who simply collect this information.
According to Troy, the fact that there is so much data out there makes us vulnerable to exploitation.
I think maybe one way of looking at this is that because of the significant size of the data and the amount of personal information in there, it does give nefarious parties a whole range of different options in terms of how they can target people, from identity thefts through to account takeover, through to just the simple frustration of endless amounts of spam that inevitably very often are sourced from data breaches.
One of the most notorious data breaches in recent memory is the hacking of Ashley Madison. The attackers followed through with a threat to publish the data of people who signed up to the controversial dating service.
Their modus operandi is, and in fact, their strapline is life is short, have an affair. And they rose to fame. I mean, the data breach was 2015, but they rose to fame years before that because they were so brazen about, look, for many people, they just need to have an affair. You know, this is a perfectly normal thing, and we built a service to do it. So they got a lot of press just based on that brazenness. And then we got through to July 2015, and someone claimed to have breached them, and they provided a proof. They provided a couple of records, which were verified. And they said, look, either Ashley Madison shuts down or we dump all the data. And they held good on that promise. So Ashley Madison didn't shut down. The data got dumped. It was around about 35 million records with very, very personal information. And when you think, if we sort of put the salaciousness of it aside for a moment, you think, what information would you actually need to collect from someone in order for them to hook up with other people? Well, you would need things like, what are your religious views, your ethnicity, your age, maybe your socioeconomic group? So you start getting all of these pieces of very personal information which you need to provide the service, but then you have an incident like this and they get leaked. And then, of course, the twist of the knife, if you like, with Ashley Madison was that it wasn't just all this personal information, but there was the stigma of you being there to have an affair.
Big data has huge potential for positive consequences.
Simon believes it's possible to flip the script on big data. He heads up the Complex Human Data Hub at the University of Melbourne's School of Psychological Sciences.
We're kind of on the nerdy side of psychology. So we're building the math models and the computational models. But of course, those are the things that you need if you're going to deal with this big data and be able to relate it to human behaviour.
Projects at the Complex Human Data Hub try to harness the power of big data to get a more accurate picture of what makes a person tick.
What we're all about in the hub is understanding, you know, how do people make decisions? How do we characterise individuals? How do we characterise how those individuals operate within their groups? And big data, you know, there's no doubt, has a huge part to play in better understanding how those processes work.
Simon thinks big data could be particularly revolutionary in the field of mental health.
Our capacity to intervene in mental health, even experts in the field will agree, is pretty limited, actually. So, you know, we have a number of techniques that we employ, but, you know, the efficacy of those techniques is not great. And, you know, we really haven't made huge progress over the last 50 years or so in being able to address those issues. I, for one, think that big data may play a significant role, because if you think about, you know, how we go about doing this at the moment, you know, we have these sessions that a clinician will do with people. They'll take some neuropsych tests at one point in time, and we use that to get our picture of what that person is all about, right, and design an intervention for them. And, yeah, there's multiple problems with that. One, that's just one point in time, and we don't know what happened for all of the rest of the time. And secondly, you know, sometimes it might be shocking, but sometimes people actually don't tell you the entire truth. The hope is that using big data, we'll be able to get a much finer grained understanding of that person. You know, same way that Facebook or Google is getting a very fine grained understanding of you in order to figure out what to try to sell you. If we were able to utilize the data in order to be able to get that kind of level of precision, I think that would allow us to design interventions that are much more appropriate for that given individual.
One example of how this model could be applied is in the treatment of bipolar disorder.
As you may be aware, bipolar patients go through ups and downs. And sometimes when they're in their downs, it can be quite problematic and even tragic in some circumstances. And so you'd like to be able to predict when that's going to happen so that healthcare professionals and family can be alerted to the fact that they need to be paying attention so that they can provide support to those individuals.
Simon and his colleagues ran a study that tracked bipolar individuals using accelerometry data, so data about their movements and GPS data.
The reason for that is to create these kind of predictive models to be able to say, okay, in 2 weeks' time, we think that this person is at risk, and so be careful. And in fact, it looks like that might be possible. There's still a lot of work to be done, but it does seem like it is possible to predict when these adverse events are going to occur. The other main reason that you might want to do it in the bipolar case is that bipolar patients are often taking different kinds of drugs to control their condition. And those drugs, the dosages of those drugs are often set so that they're sufficient for when they're in their worst states. But of course, they're not always in their worst state. And so that means that a lot of the time the dosage is actually more than what they strictly require at that particular time. And that's problematic because the drugs have long-term consequences or side effects. And so what we'd like to be able to do is avoid those side effects. And so if we could adjust dosage based on the big data that's coming in about an individual, then we'd be able to decrease the total amount of drug that an individual receives and therefore ameliorate the side effects.
Simon also wants to open up the benefits of using big data to other researchers in science and medicine. To do this, he leveraged off a system he had co-developed for his own research called Unforgettable.
Unforgettable really is, the commercial arm of the same enterprise. So what we're hoping to do there is just make it easier for researchers to be able to use big data. So, at the moment, it's dominated by the big tech companies, Facebook and Google and so forth, because they're the ones that have the infrastructure. They're the ones that have the resources to be able to access and analyze that data. And, for an individual researcher, in a university or other research institution, that's just not available, right? If they have to set up their own infrastructure for that on a case-by-case basis, that's just prohibitively time-consuming and expensive.
So Simon's team offer an alternative, a pool of data collected via Unforgettable.
Unforgettable
has an app, and the app is available for Android users and collects GPS, accelerometry, and some obfuscated audio. But that's only one of many ways, well, over 600 ways that we collect data using the Unforgettable system. So we're able to connect to services like Facebook and Twitter and so forth. We're able to connect to devices like your scales or things like that, your washing machine, your car and so forth. And we're also able to take data after the fact. So if you've collected, say, data on Twitter, over a long period of time, then we can get a user to download that data and we can enter that into the system. So there are lots and lots of ways in which the data comes into the system, but the user always decides what data they're actually supplying. And they can always turn the stream on or off depending on what they want.
The idea is that individuals hooked up to Unforgettable can then opt to share their data with researchers.
To give an example of one, some of my own work, so my area of interest is human memory. And so one of the things that's always been a challenge for us in memory research is that we're kind of stuck in the laboratory. So we can tell you a lot about how people remember lists of words, but not everyone's all that enthralled by how people remember lists of words. And the kinds of issues that people might be more interested in are things like, how often can people remember where they were at any given time, for instance. So that might be important, for instance, if you're a person's giving an alibi and you want to have an understanding of how likely are they to misremember that, or for instance, for COVID tracking, you know, it's obviously important to know how often people are just going to simply misremember. So we ran a study like that, and so it was using the GPS coordinates, and then we asked people after a week where they'd been at different times and asked them to select. And they were right about 66% of the time, which of course means they were wrong about 33% of the time. So that allowed us to kind of get a sense, right? So if you think of it in practical terms, that means, you know, when you're going into a COVID interview, for instance, then about a third of the time you're going to be wrong when you answer queries about where you were. And so that's important to know so that you get a sense of, you know, what the reliability is that you're dealing with.
Crucially, this model aims to empower and remunerate the individual.
One of the key aspects of this, I guess, which we're hoping will make it different from some of the current approaches, is that it is licensing the data. So the data continues to be owned by the participants, and they're free to license that to many different researchers, and they get compensated for it. So the fact that they're making choices on a case-by-case basis means that hopefully they're making informed choices.
So there's this term that's being used a lot, which is data breach fatigue. Yeah, people are just, they're like, ah, crap, another day. Oh, it's just the internet, it's normal now, you know, and they get on with life.
We're back with data consultant Troy Hunt. For over a decade, Troy has run haveibeenpwned.com, a website that lets the public check if their email has been compromised. His site processes thousands of search requests each day. Yet Troy believes that the onslaught of data breaches in recent times hasn't been much of a deterrent.
For the most part, there is not immediate impact on most individuals in a data breach. Now, that's not to say that makes it okay, but I think the experience sort of shows us that unless there is some immediate impact on individuals, I do believe that they become quite nonchalant. Now, the other thing I think that's really interesting socially about all this is that we now have a new generation of adults who have never known a time where you didn't share information very liberally, and a time without social media, without sharing, frankly, inane volumes of information online. And I think that there is now a fundamentally different social tolerance to the extent to which we share information.
Professor Simon Dennis.
I'm not sure I'd entirely agree with Troy about the younger generation, because I interact with them because they're participants on our platform, and there's certainly a more sophisticated understanding of what you're giving away.
But Simon also recognises that creating a market for selling personal data has plenty of challenges. For one thing, putting a price on that data.
Because most people are just giving up their data for free these days, it's not even in people's consciousness, right? So, you know, GPS might be worth one thing, accelerometry another thing, an image another thing, my genetic code, something entirely different. And so there's no kind of, you know, market with that includes the individual for that data, right? And so we don't have any of those kind of market signals that you might, you know, expect to have for other kinds of commodities. We were asking researchers to set what they thought was an appropriate price. They didn't have any idea. And so they were basically coming back up to us saying, well, what should we put here? You know. So as a consequence of that, we've actually come up with our own set of prices, and we take into account, you know, how much data is it and what kind of data it is, and et cetera. How much effort was involved for you to collect it.
And how much are participants on average being paid?
Perhaps if I give you just kind of the range. So we typically, in my memory experiments, collect data for, say, somewhere between 2 weeks and 3 months. And sometimes that would be just passive data, but sometimes, you know, we're asking people to fill out surveys, and sometimes micro surveys where it'll be like 8 times a day that they're doing this. So obviously it varies dramatically, right? Because if you're asking somebody to fill out a survey 8 times a day, there's a lot of labor involved in that. But a typical participant would get somewhere between, say, $25 and $100. Now, are they the right figures? I really don't know. You know, I guess we'll find out over time.
Another challenge is getting researchers on board with the fact that they don't have a free rein over the data.
You know, this is a bit of a difficult thing for researchers to accept, because they, in the past, they've just got the data and done whatever they liked with it, right? And now we're trying to get them to accept that, no, in fact, that data doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the participants. And you can't just, you know, give that to whoever you like. But what I say to them is that, you know, when you get into this big data, it's not just a matter of collecting the data and it'll all be good. It really matters that the participant is being diligent about the way they collect the data. And so if they have a stake in collecting and curating a complete set of data, that really helps the data quality. And it's a big issue in big data. So, yeah, I think there are positives to be had in terms of how that works.
Troy believes there are clear things online services can do right now to improve data security for individuals, like collect as little data as possible and store it for the shortest period possible.
I'm gobsmacked by the number of times people go and subscribe to a service and the service asks for information which is just entirely useless.
He points to the example of the feline-focused website, catforum.com.
There are questions on catforum.com along the lines of, is it safe to eat out of the same bowl as my cat? It is literally a forum to talk about random cat-related crap. Now, this is a real thing. There is a catforum.com. You go there and you sign up. It will ask you for your date of birth. And I sort of look at this and go, well, why do you need your date of birth to comment on cats? It seems like a very irrelevant piece of information. And I kid you not, every time I sort of lament this on Twitter, people will come back and they'll say, well, you need to have date of birth because of COPPA in the US, the Child Online Protection Act. We need to know that you're 13 or older. And I'll go, okay, well, why don't you just ask them, are you 13? Because if you just asked if they were 13 and didn't have their birth date, now you don't have a piece of information that you can't lose. And people, every single time, they come back and say, well, you can't do that because people could lie. And I was just going, oh my God.
As the potential and reach of big data grows, Simon thinks regulation can make the market safer and fairer.
What we're going to see, right, is in over the next decade or so, is governments becoming much more involved in this process because it's really the Wild West. And there needs to be a much tighter regulatory environment as people come to understand their data, because that's the big problem at the moment. They just don't really even understand what's there, right? So certainly what our hope and our vision is at Unforgettable is that by, you know, allowing them to monetize it, that then gives them a real reason to be actually involved in the process. And I think, you know, it won't be everybody, of course, but there will be larger groups of people who are really starting to grapple with some of these issues about, you know, what should the data be worth and so forth. So I'm hopeful that we will see a more informed populace in time.
And that's the episode. I'd like to thank our guests for today, Professor Simon Dennis and Troy Hunt. Psych Talks is supported by the University of Melbourne's School of Psychological Sciences. Our producer was Carly Godden, and our assistant producers were Amy Bougea and Mairead Murray. Arch Cuthbertson was our sound engineer, and music was composed by Chris Falk. Catch more episodes of Psych Talks with me, Lynn Malcolm, by subscribing to our show wherever you get your podcasts from.